Oh, yes. Hello. Welcome all to 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. That is a bittersweet sound, isn't it, Connor?
Yes, it is. It's a, you know, I brought that into the world, and who knows if we'll ever hear it again.
That's right. This is, sadly, the final episode of 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. Are you, how are you feeling about this, Connor?
You know, it's, you know, you say it's sad because it's the last one, but it means that we've reached the end of this book, and when we're done, I'll remove it from my living space, and I won't look at it again. So, it's got its pros and cons, like many things in this life we lead.
Yes, it does. It is, like I said, it's bittersweet. There's an upside too. We have to remember that.
Very strong,
very strong upside. This is the podcast where Connor Listoka and I am Mike Nelson. We do work together over at RiffTracks.com, and Connor thought it would be a good idea. Remember, I always want to keep pointing the fact that it was your idea.
You seem to bring it up a lot. I hadn't really noticed that until now.
It's to give you both credit and blame. I just want to, I'm hedging my bets on that one. But we are reading through the book Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, the soon-to-be major motion picture by Steven Spielberg, and we are reaching the end of it. If you have been listening, you have read up to this point. I know all of you have read every single word.
Yeah.
I assume, right?
Yep. Yeah, there's, you know, I would be crazy, like I've said before, to be listening to all this without experiencing all the pros and twists and deep character development and arcs and without experiencing it for yourself firsthand.
Right, and we'll get to all that. Maybe just a quick up to this point thing. Once again, for those of you who are reading along, you already know, but virtual reality world in 2044, some little punk kid plays video games to win $1 billion from an eccentric billionaire who created the virtual reality world in which he lives to escape the dystopian nightmare that the world has become in 2044, correct?
Yeah, and he does that pretty much that treasure hunt by beating video games and reciting movies verbatim, which is described in prose on a page. It would be a strange thing to watch someone do, and it's even a stranger thing to read about someone doing.
Yes, and so far every challenge it's a series of challenges. Every challenge has been what Connor just said, is doing the video games or memorizing movies.
Reciting something, yeah.
Yeah, but we're getting to the final challenge, and so obviously this is going to be quite a bit different.
He's going to switch it up because it's the final stage. It would be weird to have it just sort of do a lukewarm, watered-down version of, you know, the things that were not that great when they came before the first time.
Of course. Every author knows that, and that will not be... His mistakes of the past will not be repeated because he's been building up to this treat. I just want to point out that we will be doing, of course, our famous department dumb sentence of the week. We have... we're sort of summing up everything at the end of the podcast here, and obviously we'll get to the meat of it in just a moment, but there was another department, Connor, that we both loved a lot, and that was fanfic or real, where we challenged one another to read a passage ahead of where we were reading or mix it up with fanfic that we pulled off of the web. I assume you didn't go to the library to get any of the fanfic.
There's a guy who scrawls things in the bathroom, but I didn't wasn't sure if he was familiar with the source material.
You didn't ride on horseback like Gandalf and go to the secret catacombs and pull out the scrolls for this, I assume.
Yes, make it more erotic, please.
So I know that that's over for us now because we've read the whole book, but I just wanted to, I couldn't let it go. And so one thing. I'm going to challenge you with one thing. And so let's do it. Let's do fanfic or real, just for old time's sake.
All right. Thank you. And now I bet they bitching because my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write about some fanfiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction that I'm living on my life. I'm living on my inner vision right now. Yeah, it'll be
in some ways it'll be sad to do this, but let's play it anyway, Connor.
We've had what, like a 50% hit rate on these?
Yeah,
it's pretty much a coin flip, which means it's pretty much indistinguishable as far as we've been able to discern.
Yeah, so this is my final one, and this is either from a piece of fanfic or this is actually in the book that you just read. fanfic or real. The game Tempest also appears briefly in the music video for the song Subdivisions by Rush, she added. any thoughts, Connor? Is that fanfic or real?
I'm going to ignore that what I've read, and I'm going to say that just I'm flipping to the back of the book here, and it says named one of the best books of 2011 by Entertainment Weekly, San Francisco Chronicle, Village Voice, Chicago Sun-Times, IO9, and the Onion's AV Club. And those are all publications that are still around and still respected. And I don't see how that could possibly be in the real book. It's got to be fan fiction.
Oh, you are wrong, Connor. Yes, of course.
I knew it. I leaned into it.
All right. Well, let's get into the meat of it because...
Well, before we do that, just to tag along with that, I thought that with what I just said, it was named the best book of 2011 by that and more. And I thought it would be fun for this final episode to have one of those people...
Oh, right.
...come on and sort of just have a discussion with it. So I reached out to the guy who reviewed the book for the AV Club. He gave it an A-. And then he also, it was his contribution to their sum up the best book of 2011. So he put Ready Player One on that list. So I reached out, said, would you like to come on and sort of just talk about this, defend your choice, as long as you're okay with us sort of being like, what the hell were you thinking? But I told him it would be good natured. As a critic, you should be able to be willing to, you're sort of a public record. No one expects these to go away as soon as you publish them. And we all make mistakes. But what I'm getting to is the guy did not respond to my email. He did not, didn't even say, it doesn't sound like my cup of tea. Don't want you guys making fun of me. He just completely ignored it. So,
well, this silence speaks volumes. So A-. A-, so it means there were only just a couple of flaws, just a here and there. He would have tucked this or emphasized this, but otherwise, perfection.
If you're giving those books we read on the very first thing, the top 10 books, if those are all A's, this is just sort of a step down.
Just a step below.
And sure, you're grading on a curve. You're saying for a popcorn book, this is fine. But if you're going to give Game of Thrones an A,
yeah, there's plenty of crowded competition within the field to not be throwing A-minuses around willy-nilly.
So, if you're another critic who's listened to this, I went to AV Club because I figured he might be a bit more accessible than the guy from... New York Times or Entertainment Weekly, but I don't know. Reach out. We'd love to talk to you again.
We'll do a special app if we get anything from, I would do that. What would you?
Absolutely. Yeah. It'd be really fun.
Addendum?
We're not going to Howard Stern you in an interview. I'm just curious when it came out, cause I'm curious, was there some sort of PR campaign where the publisher was like, hey, this is a big deal. It's got these things. You need to talk about it. It's a geek fantasy type of thing. So I assume something like that happened because the tide seems to have turned very quickly on the book. So I'm curious what was in the water back in 2011.
Well, maybe it's, those inexplicable, when films get lauded and everyone knows they're garbage. And then you realize after the fact that they had one of those great junkets that they bring all the critics on. So there was a famous critic who was they call him a junket whore, their term, not mine. And he was well known. Another critic was telling me this, that he saw him at the buffet for Free Willy 2. And he was like, he was very enthusiastic. This is one of the better buffets we've had, he said. So he knew he was going to get a good review from Free Willy 2. So maybe that's what happened with this book. Who knows?
Yeah, they could have sent out a cool, packaging for the book that had the little DeLorean Ghostbusters car or something. And that could have been enough to turn the tide.
Swayed them. All right. Well, let's
assume that's what happened. Let's assume that is what these people did, and that's what did it. They got free Matchbox cars, and that's why it got all these good reviews. That's the record until someone clarifies it for us.
Oh, I like that call out. I think that's going to work. Throw that lure out there. All right. Should we get into the meat of it?
Yeah. So we've left the action last time with our hero. They're planning the raid on Anorak Castle. The planet where that lives. They've called all the Gunters in existence to come out to make a massive raid on the IOI, even though they They don't know if any of the other Gunters are going to help him. They don't know if they are going to be able to take down their shield, but Wade has a plan, and he's leaving his Fortress of Falco to put that plan into action.
That's right, and they all have chosen robots, right? All of our heroes have, our four remaining heroes have chosen.
Yeah, you received a robot when you beat the Black Tiger game, I think. Yeah, Black Tiger. Mm-hmm. You got to, if you're one of the first 100 people, Halliday has, you know, meticulously crafted these replica robo mechs that you got to your choice of picking. And they were beaten to this by like 10 IOI guys. So they had like the remaining 90 robots to pick from. And Wade picked one, I don't even, Leopardon.
Yes, Leopardon, if that's how it's pronounced. He seems to have a knack for picking things that make you doubt your own pronunciation of them. There's a whole bunch of those in here where I'm just like, is this how you, I don't know, Leopardon, right. Okay.
Sure, that's how it's written, and it comes from the Spider-Man, which is, I guess, the Japanese way of saying Spider-Man.
Yes. So he gets in his rig. Are they still rigs? No, he's, I don't know.
Oh, man, that is a very
a rig
good
within
question.
A rig? I don't know.
It is. It really is. It's a rig, and it's also a mech.
Yeah.
And I don't, that sort of is a term he uses to the assumption that we all know how to use it. And I guess, you know, I looked it up today. The Pacific Rim movie came out in 2013, which is probably where this sort of concept really got popularized.
Yes.
But I guess he beat it to it. So maybe he had an original thought there. But yeah, he's got Leopardon, and he starts the chapter off by trying to figure out how to use this thing. He's got a toy, but he didn't have enough time. Somehow he didn't have enough time to run the magic spells to a guy who has nothing but time to memorize books and read entire bibliographies. To sort of was like, oh, crap, I guess I should have got around to figuring out how this toy works. But fortunately, it didn't take him long how to figure out what the command word was he needed to activate this robot, because you just shout its name like in the TV show.
Yes.
And I would hope that didn't take him long, because if it's exactly how it works in the TV show, that would probably be the first thing I would try.
Yeah, and he said something that I found very curious. Cause so he did the voice commands twice in a short span, and then he added this little addendum to it. The voice commands only work if you shouted them. But he's only shouted them. So I just couldn't, like, how does he know? It wasn't there was no description of, oh, dang, it stalled when I said it in a timid voice. When I whispered it sexily to it, it didn't. There was nothing. He was just shouting. He shouted two words. It worked both times. And he said, I learned it only worked when he shouted at it.
Yeah, I flagged that too, because that's, once you've read this book, you learn to recognize these Kleinian things where, yes. I was like, so is this going to come up later? I wrote it down. And then, you know, my second read through was like, does not matter. Yes. It's oddly specific. It is irrelevant. And another Kleinian thing, he undermines it, because when he has to eject his robot, when it's falling or something, he pulls a lever to eject.
Yes.
He doesn't shout, activate eject seat into the robot's microphone. So it's,
Yes. And then another thing that I noted just a paragraph down from that, the robot's arms, legs, and head folded inward and locked into new positions, transforming the robot into a starship known as the Marveler. So he's inside of it while it happened. How the hell does he know that? Like, what? Transforming it into a starship known as the Marveler.
I guess that just must be what happens in the cartoon, so he's aware of it. So, But it, you know, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. It's just, it's once again, it's fan service where you're just like, think of the opening of the thing. And now I'm going to mention the Marveler and, everybody? But as an actual sentence from a guy who doesn't know what the hell the Marveler is or what the hell he's doing, it's like, what, that is nonsensical.
Right. The Marveler doesn't, maybe it has abilities that the robot doesn't have or can fly faster, some nonsense, but it just goes to a Stargate and transports there and then turns back into a robot. So, yeah, it's exactly what you said. It's just it's just checking that box for fans of who actually know what Leopardon is. It's great. But then he shows up, turns right back into the robot, and then says, my ship stood out in the vast array of vessels since it was the only giant robot.
Can I indulge me in reading? There was a. It's a longer quote. It's a couple sentences.
All right.
But I didn't want to flag just a part of it. It's so delicious. It's he's in the robot and Artemis appears. The towering female robot Artemis was piloting. It was black and chrome in color with elaborate boomerang-shaped headgear and symmetrical red breastplates that made it look like a female version of Transor Z. Period.
Okay.
Period.
Sure.
Then I realized it was the female version of Transor Z, an obscure character from the original Mazinger Z anime series known as Minerva X. If you can come up with a paragraph that would annoy the shit out of me more than that, I challenge you to do that.
It's like it reminded me of the exchange between him and H at the end of the last chapter where H says, it looks like Rivendell, and he goes, it looks exactly like Rivendell from the Lord of the Rings. Except he's doing it to his own thought process.
Yes. Oh, that was astonishing.
But yeah, they show up and like every Gunter has gathered, so he says it's like just littered with spaceships and Gunter ships and all this garbage, but he says the amount of people that have gathered here, it makes the scene look like some otherworldly Woodstock.
Yes.
So that really stood out to me because I guess in the 40s, that would be a 2044, that's a 75-year-old reference.
Yes.
To something from the 60s, which he's never mentioned before. And we were just talking about it. Lauren was just like, well, there has to be, this has been supplanted by now. Like at some point in time in my life, I realized that Woodstock was only as important as it was because the people who were writing these magazines and stuff were the ones who liked that.
Right.
Like they were the ones who were old enough to remember that. But we have, you know, Woodstock type festivals dozens of times every single summer now.
Right.
but even then there was a Woodstock in the 80s called Live Aid, which would be, you know, it was pretty cool. There were some good performances there, and that would clearly be something that Halliday would have been tuned into if he was making references to festivals. So even,
yeah. He doesn't dip into classic 80s when he yes. when he could. So they all gather, and this was one of the most curious sentences I think I read, and it continued to be a raspberry seed in my wisdom tooth to use a up to the date reference that I'm sure they're still using.
Very nice.
In 2044. Yes. He says he sees Artemis or H, sorry, and says, even though I now knew H was actually a female in real life, her avatar was still male, so I decided to continue to refer to him as such.
That's in parentheses.
But
yes.
To whom are you referring? It's like nothing is ever spoken to her or him or whatever or to other people. He's talking about how he's going to refer to it his readers, and it is the clumsiest, dumbest thing.
It's like his editor was like, hey, what are you doing? And he just left in the note he wrote in response to her
exactly.
in the margins in the book. Like, hey, like this is we're nearing the end now. We don't need any we don't need to worry about these things. So this is just how it's going to be. Laying it out.
Yeah, because
you.
He's just saying H. So what? Hey, H, a guy, yes. your avatar is a guy, H. Is that what he's doing? Like, is he calling it out? Nothing is changing in terms of his communication with H. So that was just freakish.
Yeah. And it stood out even more just because he put it in parentheses right there. I guess it was probably just answering a question of, you know, the 0.01% of people who might have been like, wait a minute, like, why are you still,
right.
you know?
Oh, God.
But something else that I thought was fun was Artemis is sort of surprised because there is this Woodstock-esque gathering here, but she's very surprised that the servers can handle it. She's like, there doesn't seem to be any lag at all here, which
oh
like,
my God.
It's like, it's the constant just mentioning of lag, even when it's not around, like the Simpsons wanted you to do with Poochie, just like anytime there's no lag, just mention the fact that there could be lag.
Right.
Just
but
to remind
lag
us,
never actually occurs ever in the book, does it?
Never has. It has never happened. Every place that he'd gone to has been even when he's in his crappy Stacks apartment, there wasn't lag. But then he moves to a place so he can have a place without lag. And then he goes into that, bodily
that
fluid,
high-end bodily fluid
place.
Shop.
Yes.
Yeah. For a lag-free connection.
Oh, the boogeyman of lag. But then, yeah, so they start planning their thing, and He's hatched this scheme in the meantime, but he hasn't told his buddies what it is. And so they're trusting him. But in the meantime, they start quoting Star Wars to each other. Han will have the shield down, H quoted. We've got to give him more time, to which he responds by laughing. to, you know, not even a joke from Star Wars, just sort of a line.
I have a very large uppercase expletive after this line with many explanation points behind it, because I was just doing it in while I was reclining, and I have a bad feeling about this makes an appearance, which just once again the Hulk-like rage, which to reference a classic 80s thing,
right? So they have a bad feeling when the guy who's murdered their friends makes an appearance.
Yes.
That causes them to have negative feelings, which, all right, sure, that makes sense. That's when Sorrento shows up, and he's got his own little dramatic thing played. He's got his 10 buddies behind him who all have their own little robots, and he's got his little robot of his own, which he turns into a big robot, and that gets a very dramatic thing. He's like, I don't have it written down, but it sort of has a paragraph. He sets his little robot on the ground, and Wade immediately recognizes this, and it gets its own paragraph, its own sentence. It was Mecha Godzilla, which was sort of just, you know, it gets that sort of dun 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 treatment.
Yeah.
To which, you know, I just was like, that it has. It's gone full Axe Cop of just a 6-year old like introducing Godzilla into the mix there.
Yeah, well, this is one of those weird occasions where I'm gonna take a different tack, Connor. I actually admired this, and I'll tell you why. Because he's cribbed from pretty much everything for this whole book. Yeah, admittedly, I mean he
what.
I know this is a shock, but in this case with Sorrento, the villain, the deep, dark, blackest villain in this book, he's actually carrying on a pretty strong literary a tradition that you know I've admired in the past, and I don't know if you knew this, but there I've just pulled up a handful of examples, and I went. I pulled out some old LPs from like the BBC, and I have a couple of examples. Other great villains of the past have done this same thing, and
it was like it's a trope, huh?
Yeah, it is a trope. Let me just drop this one in here. This is from Macbeth. This is Lady Macbeth in
Jeez.
Her. Yeah, no, I know it's weird. People forget this part of it because, you know, Macbeth is the star, but Lady Macbeth is sort of the beating heart of the villainry that the two of them eventually take on together. But here's her speech where she sort of wills herself to be evil. So let's listen to that.
Come to my women's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers. Wherever in your slightest substances you wait on nature's mischief, come, thick night, and pall thee in thy dunnest smoke of hell. Kyrie-o!
So yeah, I mean
it's not up there with double toil and trouble, but it's powerful.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff, and there's another one in we have to jump quite a bit ahead here, but also the British book, the 1984 by Orwell, who was of course describing the villainy that he saw in the somewhat new Soviet establishment of how they. They unmanned and they stole people's humanity through the bloodless bureaucracy. And this is O'Brien, who sort of symbolizes all the evil of just that crushing lack of humanity. And here's him confronting our hero.
Obedience is not enough. Unless a man is suffering, how can you be sure that he is obeying your will and not his own? Power is in inflicting pain and humiliation. Power is in tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Do you begin to see, then, what kind of world we are creating? Progress in our world will be progress towards more pain. The old civilizations claimed that they were founded on love or justice. Ours is founded upon hatred.
Transor Z! From the minds of mortal men, the mightiest of machines, Transor Z!
Huh?
Wow, yeah, that's he really got the sound effects right there too. Like
yeah,
that was,
yeah, he did. He had those on hand. So
I take it all back. This is a honored and longstanding tradition.
Yeah.
Of so villains pulling out tiny robots.
So I give him I give him kudos on that. Well done. Yes, if you're going to steal from the best.
That's powerful stuff. I regret not working it into my own work. That's
Well, you have a long life ahead of you.
Right. Yes. But yeah, so it goes on to have this whole scene of him sort of like in the Godzilla suit, punching the guys, and it always has the funny thing that I imagine of where he's making the noises in the suit. Like we did the movie Iron Man at Rift Tracks, and they have this great scene where Obadiah Stane is wearing a giant robot suit, but he's still going like, grrr, as he's like punching and lurching about. And it's like, really, you're just sitting in that thing making those grunt noises. And then it also was very similar to the end of Avatar, where the military guy, gets in the suit, and then, they have a robot knife fight where he pulls out the giant thing and like that sort of. And so when you sort of, I guess it's easy to read this and be like, okay, sure, Godzilla is lurking about. But like when you really see it, it looks really ridiculous when it is like a guy like piloting with joysticks, like these giant robots. And when he's adding his own sound effects, it's very funny. Sorrento laughs really loud at some point in time, which was reminded me of Jeff Bridges.
Right. Through his. He describes like, the booming loudspeaker that comes out of the robot. And then you always have to remember that, again, Sorrento's just like in a booth with a rig on.
Right,
so so his booming voice is coming through. I was like, what? There's just so many layers. It's so hard to, that drama just doesn't come across.
Not at all. And, it's like people, it was the original defense of the Transformers movies where it was like, hey, man, it's just, it's giant robots kicking the crap out of each other. You just got to turn off your brain and enjoy it.
Right.
And it was like what I always think about that is like, OK, if these giant robots, if I could, buy a ticket and go watch that happen at like a stadium, like I would probably do that.
Right.
Because sure, that would be pretty cool. But it just is. It's so devoid of anything that would make that cool, which is actually experiencing the scope of those giant robots. Like the physicality of like explosions and like the impacts they would be making would be very cool to see. But when you're just sort of watching the Transformers do that and all physics are being defied and like there's no scope because it's on a movie screen, it does nothing for me to have that. Yeah, like you said, that removal. And this has two steps of removal from it. So I reject that thesis that it's entertaining to watch movie giant robots beat the crap out of each other.
Yeah, it's the worst for drama. Yeah.
But
his plan, I was just going to talk about his plan involves, this one didn't come, he's not very, either I'm straying in my concentration in my notes, but he's got some little robot that crawls up the side of the thing or something like that?
Not any robot. This was something where I wrote the expletives in the book as well, but he says there's some service bots, and it says, due to a lack of imagination on the part of the supply droid's original designer, they all looked exactly like Johnny Five from the 1986 film Short Circuit.
Right.
And for this guy to have the nerve, the utter gall to call out anyone else's lack of imagination is just so offensive.
That's a lot of gall.
It is outrageous. I don't even know where to begin with that. It's why even bring it up at that point in time? Like everyone is like the Blade Runner building was default and all the thing. Like,
yeah, all of a sudden he's knocking on the person who copied something else before. Right. They were getting nothing but effusive praise.
Yes,
now
exactly.
Suddenly he's backhanding the people to it.
Yeah, to like a cool robot. Like, I mean, Johnny Five's a good design for a robot. Like, it's better than just having it be a little Roomba thing running around. Like,
right.
Yeah. So that was a fun bomb to drop with 20 pages left in your awful book.
But it leads me to one of the, speaking of his technique, this is a slightly subtle, but I think you'll get it. And it cracked me up that he's written it obviously in just first person the whole time. And he's seeing it with his own eyes and describing everything. And so he has to make this when he tries to do something else. He tries a literary technique here. And by doing it this way, I didn't witness it firsthand, but I can tell you with some certainty that this is what happened next. And it's like, well, that's a relief because you're the author. You are literally right. You are the authority on that. And then later he says, at this point, SD3 may have drawn a few curious looks from the squadron of the elite Sixer avatars guarding the platform. I have no way of knowing.
Wow.
I think it's kind of adorable that he got lost trying to come up with a way to describe action he didn't see, so he just kind of gives up on it.
Like, first hand part of.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but come on, guys. Let's imagine that they're giving each other curious looks.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably something that he considered stylistic. Like, it's sort of like a, you know, in Ocean's 11, they sort of narrated, like, some of these schemes that they weren't part of, like, you know, just as a montage that they did sort of like that. So I'm imagining he did that with sort of an eye towards a cinematic thing where the character might be narrating that and it shows this action happening. But
he also has 800, he's living in a virtual reality. They say that they have cameras around inside the virtual reality. Why couldn't he give it a 2-second description of later? I would laugh when I saw the footage of, you know, whatever. He's got a million clumsy, stupid ways to do that.
Yeah. I had a magical item I've never mentioned before that was Jack Sparrow's magic telescope that hovered in the sky and I could train it on any part of the castle. So then I was able to see it.
But here I have no way of knowing after giving the description.
So Johnny Five goes and blows that up, triggering the walls coming down. And then perhaps it's good that he sort of didn't really know how to describe all that action, because when he does try to describe what happens, it doesn't go well.
No.
He says that once the battle starts, a chaotic, breathtaking scene unfolds, like several beehives and wasp nests had been smashed together and then dropped on a giant anthill.
Yep.
So that's the ultimate battle for you know, the universe there is just, you know, kicking a bunch of insects together.
I can't imagine that he ran out of movie references to pull from. So, yes. But yeah, when he does try his own descriptions, you're right. He should just not attempt it. Just tell us what movie we're supposed to be looking at.
I wonder if he was like, you know, I felt like how the bees, or how I imagined the wasps must feel.
Yes.
To paraphrase his shark description earlier in the book. But yeah, so this was my one of my favorite parts is the chaos unfolds and the robots start shooting, you know, beams out of their giant metal breasts. And then he says that some of Sorrento's buddies who had pulled out their own tiny little robots, they were quickly destroyed or disabled the other Sixer mechs who never even got a chance to form Voltron. So that it disproves that ancient sort of literary playwright technique of Chekhov's Voltron, wherein if you have guys who might form Voltron, they will then form Voltron in Act 3. It was very disappointing. It was just sort of, I guess, ticking the boxes of, you know, mentioning Voltron could have been formed.
Yes, boy. Once again, I made that sort of a variant on his, and I have a couple examples coming up, his immediate dissipation of anything dramatic or exciting. He's got a couple spectacular versions of that.
Does indeed.
But I have a challenge for the listening audience out there of this bit of action that happens when the dome collapses. He let out a silent cheer. I challenge anyone in the audience to do that.
Someone did called my attention to that on Twitter. That was a silent cheer. That's
But also, why? Why does he have to be? I don't understand why he has to be silent.
Yeah, Sorrento's cackling with evil laughter in his rig. Like, why
he's
isn't
throwing
he?
Throwing his robot head back and hands on hips and mocking them. What? Yeah. Why not?
I mentioned, I said he was cackling. He was, the line was, the metal beast let out another ear-splitting shriek, followed by hollow, booming laughter. Sorrento's laughter.
Ooh.
So it was a good addition because I thought that might have been like Irock's laughter.
Right.
You remember Irock? He was he played a major role in this book for. But so
Rock
it was
Connor.
Good that he clarified.
You've insulted me. Of course, I know who Irock is. Who's Irock? I forgot.
Irock is going to be played by T.J. Miller in the book. I learned that in the movie. I learned that. I don't know if that means he's playing him or voicing him, but since he's on screen for a scene. It's a really good casting decision, getting a big name like that to play a character who shows up and calls someone a crap burger. But yeah, so this is they're all heading in their robots to finally go to the key. Shoto's hanging back, and he says that our hero says that something about the tone of his voice bothered him.
Mm-hmm. His robot's voice, I assume.
Sure, yes, I guess whatever's coming over the comm link. So you might say he has a bad feeling about it. But
you so Shoto... go on ahead without me. Oh, wait a minute, Shoto. I've known you too long, my friend.
Yes, but Shoto says that he owes this son of a bitch some payback because he murdered his friend. He wants to get a. But this is, you know, he has no way of actually getting payback. Since it isn't just his avatar. So he's going to take an eye for a virtual eye. And he does. He sort of like he shoots. Oh, no, he has a big sword that he launches in and chops off Mechagodzilla's arm with.
Oh, yes. Do you want to read it?
Yeah, I do, because I think
this is my it's a dumb sentence of the week.
Yeah.
Nominee. But there's no reason to hold this for the end.
No, like, yeah, this, I think I wrote down that this is probably my dumb sentence of the book.
Okay, I agree.
It just, so because, we'll play some more at the end of this, but he cuts off his right arm, and this is the man who has literally murdered his best friend, threw him off a 43rd story balcony, and he has just dealt his avatar's tiny robot a little bit of damage.
Yeah, a guy who can, we should reiterate, can and does jump into other avatars immediately because he's the boss of a giant company that's doing nothing but, right. Well, I mean, they're doing, they're throttling data and stuff like that, but but their largest act of evil. So he's got literally a limitless number of avatars to jump into. So with that, go ahead.
Yes, he strikes down his arm and then... probably must have been planning out something like this, but unleashes the quip. Looks like you'll be wiping with your left hand now, Sorrento, Shoto shouted triumphantly.
I think just let that sit there with people for a while. Let's think of that. Come on. Mm-hmm. He shouted triumphantly. There's another challenge for everyone out there. Shout this line triumphantly. Looks like you'll be wiping with your left hand now, Sorrento.
Yeah, open a window and scream it out like Howard Beale told everyone to.
That's right. See what,
you'll get a neighbor throw a brick at your face or something. Think of a better quip.
So Shoto sacrifices himself to take down Sorrento. It doesn't work.
Yeah, Wade says he was dead. You know, not really, of course. It's not like he was thrown off a 43rd story balcony. He's just game over. He has to start from the beginning. But yeah, he... I guess distracts the guy, and Wade is able to turns around and sees all this happening, and so his mech has been destroyed, but he has the Ultraman capsule left,
mm-hmm.
and he activates that and turns into Ultraman, who's another giant robot. So it's a weird little just trades one giant robot for another, and then he's able to focus the beam on Godzilla, who's like knocks him down and he's writhing on his back like a turtle, I guess, and Sorrento is struggling with the controls, which is another just funny thing to imagine, the
exactly.
the removed two-layer aspect of that, what Sorrento looked like in his rig as he was like on his back, kind of like, because he's got a hell of a rig. He probably actually is like upside down since it's like manipulating you.
Right. He probably spilled his vitamin water all over, you know, like, son of a...
Damn it, I just had this like, you know, Armani suit dry cleaned. It's going to get all wrinkled. But yeah, so he's trying to... as soon as he's like about to get his revenge, he just says like Sorrento had tried to kill me. And in the process, he'd murdered my aunt along with several of my neighbors, including sweet old Miss Gilmore, who'd never hurt a soul. He'd also had Dato killed. We're like, okay, well, lead with that. And several of your neighbors, like, you know, we did the math. It was going to be a ton more than that.
Right. Yeah. He started a blaze in a stack, man. I mean, there's no way anybody got out of there alive.
So he shoots him and he ejects in Godzilla's head and he shoots it like a clay pigeon.
Yes, but this is the exact moment I want to also challenge our listening audience with a rewrite on a sentence. Let's just try a rewrite on this. When you remember the sentence song, right?
Yes. Oh, please.
Yes. Here's the sentence. Just before the entire machine exploded, the head detached and blasted away from the neck. Let's try a rewrite on that sentence, maybe.
Okay.
The head detached and blasted away from the neck just before the entire machine exploded. I don't know. That's sometimes sometimes sentences go in chronological order. I suggest here, while describing action, that might be the way to go. I don't know.
Yes. And, you know, when the head detaches, it's probably going to be from the neck, the place that the head is typically attached to in most configurations.
I just thought that was so odd. Like, this is supposed to be the triumphant death of your enemy, and then there's like a niggling detail, and then, you know, he exploded. But before he did, I got to tell you that his head detached from the thing. So wouldn't that's cool, right? Like, it's so stupid.
So he dies, and then Wade heads into the castle to finally take care of this business. And that's where he sees his deep love of his life, who he's done this whole thing for. He said it was no matter what happens, it was all going to be worth it because he's going to get to meet his beloved Artemis.
Mm-hmm.
So she's, you know, just as happy to see him. She gives him the finger because she seems just great. And at some point in time, like they're wrapping this all up, and Artemis is like, yeah, we're all here. Let's go. And he says, I could hear the barely contained rage in her voice. So just you can tell why he's gone to all these lengths. And, you know, at this point, he's sort of like, the billions don't matter. Like, I just am going to meet this love, this angel who is giving me the finger and griping about the money and wants his assurances in writing and like just really turning the screws to me.
Yeah, I have a couple. I have a little young love passage, if you'll indulge me.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's right around that moment. You're such a selfish asshole, Artemis shouted. What if you'd gotten yourself killed? I didn't, though, did I? So chill out and let's open this thing.
Wow.
Yes. Young love.
Right. And, you know, I think that the whole thing is pretty very contingent on, you know, okay, well, not to skip ahead, but it works out okay for them. But it is very contingent on him getting the money at this point in time. Like, I feel like if he had gotten shot there, there's no way she would have been like, all right, well, everything I've worked for the past 6 years has been ruined and I'm poor and people still want me dead. But let's go on a date, you idiot.
Like, that's, right. I'll meet you outside the booth, you loser.
Yes.
I just want to add one thing just because it's a time dependent. When he joins H and Artemis, he says again, he goes, I missed a skirmish that had obviously just happened. And it just got me wishing that he'd have guessed again what it might have been like.
Yes.
I wasn't there. Look, I cannot attest to any of this, but here's how it might have gone. I just wish he had done that.
This sounds like a thing that I've brought up on here before. Maybe I've just mentioned it to you. It would be very weird if it's the second time I brought it up, but there was a DC guy, Ken Beatrice, who would always say, he would do ads for Arby's, and he would always say, I don't eat curly fries, but I'm told they're very good,
right.
Which is very much a technique he's used. If I brought that up more than once, I'm sorry for bringing up the DC Sports Talk Radio from the late 80s, but it's a very apt comparison.
I wasn't there,
but I think this is what happened.
Yeah, I think that is that's number two on you bringing it up, and I could use more, I'll tell you that.
Yes, I'll work it in every time.
So they go through the gate, right? Which
okay.
They do the thing that they already knew.
Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah. Yeah, it puzzles them for a second, which I don't understand. They'd already figured that out, and they called everyone fools who hadn't memorized every bit of Schoolhouse Rock. How could they be so foolish to not memorize every line of Schoolhouse Rock?
What are they, dilettantes?
Dilettantes, yes. So they forget their own knowledge for 1 second, but then they do it. And they chant. They say the words, what is it, charity, faith, hope, and charity, or whatever.
I don't know, Mike. I'm an atheist, so I would not have.
But then
those words are meaningless.
That has no meaning other than that it was in Schoolhouse Rock, I guess. So it really,
right?
They haven't done anything. It's not like one represents one represents the next. There's none of that.
It's not like the Wizard of Oz or something where they all sort of are, you know, compensating for different little things that they're lacking.
Yeah, and I'll save it for when we sum up, but that feeds into the major theme of it, and I think we've brought it up before, but we can close out with that later. We'll get through this. So he goes in, and then they're dead, right? That's how he ends the chapter. Then we all died.
Yes. And that, you know, at this point, I was just like, my God, a twist. This is not what I saw. I gasped. I took a walk around the block because this came out. They died.
Yeah.
They had gone all this way to have him pull the rug out under us like this. It was shocking.
I considered, I briefly considered stopping there and just to be obstinate and saying, oh, they said he died. So, and then coming to this podcast with no knowledge of what happens after that.
Yes.
Just to spite, I don't know who that would spite exactly, but
there is a popular Stephen King series that sort of ends with him daring you to keep reading, and that would have been a great thing for him to do there. Like, yeah, this is how it ends, suckers. Yeah, you want to keep reading? Like, I guarantee you it doesn't end well. Call my bluff on this one.
So they're dead, but of course they're not.
Yep, no. He wastes a page and a half of pretending that it's dead. He sort of describes what happens when your avatar dies, which is like a very video gamey thing. But then he just reveals that he had an extra life. It was like, why did you waste our time? Every single person knew this was not how it's going to be. Like, there was no dark twist coming. We were waiting to see how it was going to happen, how the latest Deus Ex was gonna play out here. And it turns out it's the quarter he got from beating Pac-Man.
Right. And this was where I thought it was new heights of his ability to instantly dissipate drama. It was game over. The words that every gamer hates to see, the nightmare. This is it. Next sentence, extra life. And then a couple sentences later, you know, he's challenged to beat this game, Tempest. I'll never beat it. And then you can get extra lives, which he immediately does. That all just happens one after the other. There is never a hint, not a bit of drama surrounding it. It all just continues in one rush.
Right. And because especially if you're, you know, if you're reading, like, you're like, well, there are 10 pages left at this point, so I understand that this is wrapping up. This is not
right.
There's going to be no additional challenges put forth here. So, but yeah, Tempest made me laugh. Because he quotes like some line that's it's the last line of Anorak's almanac, and it says, "I must uneasy make less too light winning make the prize light," and Artemis is like, "Yeah, that's from." He's like, "That's from Shakespeare." She's like, "Yeah, it's from The Tempest." And he's like, "Oh, how did I miss that?" And I was like, "Well, because your dumbass was probably watching Family Ties or, you know, jacking it to Sailor Moon or something. You're humping your sex doll."
Like, we know exactly why you missed that.
Yes,
you have no other frame of reference.
Yes, it's to somehow have done the research. He certainly didn't recognize that as Shakespeare on his own, but to have looked up that was a Shakespeare line and missed the Tempest connection is a gigantic failing. And you know, Tempest is sort of famously his last play, which would make the placement in the almanac even more significant. So it just yet again sort of proves that our hero was a dumbass.
Yeah, and in this passage were a couple of things that stood out to me just as individual lines, and I just don't want to pass them by. Someone says, we'll be as dead as doornails.
Okay.
So that's a saying still going strong with 18-year-olds in 2044. I think my uncle from World War II probably said that was the last time.
That was actually a popular saying by 1980s DC sports talk radio host Ken Beatrice.
Oh, Mike, yes. You don't say.
Forgive me if I've not brought him up until now. But
another one was smooth move X-Lax, which yes. I thought the company would be, sort of feel confidence in their brand management that they were still being referenced in 2044.
Yeah, they really
by Gunters.
Got the ironic, Gunter crowd still bringing up their product.
And the other was something happened like Wile E. Coyote in the old Roadrunner cartoons. So not the Wile E. Coyote from the Bible.
That or Wile E. Coyote.
Yes. Just a couple of lines there.
There was a couple things in this section that I thought were good too. Things that he references as if they're well-known things that we've never heard about in the book before. He says before he plays Tempest, he began his pregame ritual, stretching, cracking my knuckles, rolling my head and neck left and right. And I went back and control F'd that. There's no mention of this ritual at any point in time, even though he spent, 33% of the book doing nothing but playing video games. It's the first we've heard of this. And then later on, when he's he's like doing something. Maybe it's during the Monty Python thing, but Artemis does something. And then it says, she laughed her little musical laugh, which is, again, I checked, the first we're hearing of this little musical laugh of hers in a book where they reference the other character's Cheshire grin every other line. He fails to mention that she had that this Rubenesque woman had a little musical laugh.
I bet you probably saw she laughed her Cheshire grin, and that was scratched out and with a little note like, must find other Ernie, horrible cliche.
No. what got a laugh was him entering his initials and then her saying, what does the O stand for? And he says, obtuse, which gets a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Draws a laugh from the audience.
a musical laugh, like the tinkling of bells.
Yes. He beats the game and, oh no, he beats the high score. And so he's been informed that the IOI is catching up with him. He's been informed that the whole world is watching, I guess.
It's a great line. This is one that really stuck out to me. He says, you mean to tell me that the entire world has been watching me play Tempest for the past hour? I agree. It's impossible to imagine any well-adjusted human being entertained by that bullshit.
Right. It's sort of a metaphor for the book as a whole.
Exactly.
Like, you know, really? New York Times bestseller list?
Right.
This isn't just sort of like something that a few weirdos are gathered in a room to hear me talk about at Comic-Con?
Yeah. Unbelievable. So he just plays it. They do the cheat or the I don't know, exploit or whatever of the game.
Right.
Because he can't beat it because it's not one of his games, man, because he didn't know what the Tempest was. So
it is, you know, a nice little humble thing. He tosses in that there is a game he hasn't mastered and a movie he hasn't memorized. So that's, you know, that's his that brings him down to earth a lot in my mind.
Right.
But then he beats the high score. And then the next line is, so he's solved that. He can move on. The IOI are hot on his heels. Then he says, I kept playing, instinctively wanting to get the highest score possible.
Right. Even though he's being chased at this point. But
You titanic dumbass. But then, so once he sort of dies in that, he moves along. It turns into, like, the reality dissipates, and he enters into this weird foggy field. And
oh, boy. And he hears he assumes that he's on a horse because he sees the up and down movement of his rig.
Yeah, we sort of spoiled this because I had flipped ahead and picked this as a fanfic or real a couple episodes ago. But I kind of wish I had come onto this fresh because I would have liked to see what my reaction was to sort of the gradual reveal of what this was.
That should be a YouTube series. People read the ultimate chapter of Ready Player One, you know, for the first time.
That would be great. Oh man,
it is. You got to give him credit. He finds new ways, doesn't he?
Yes.
I thought he'd exhausted my patience on page one, but man, does this go? This goes deep.
Yeah, it is. He enters another flick sync like he did with War Games, but this time it's Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which he refers to as the most beloved geek film of all time. And
yeah.
And, if we're going to just, you know, apply that word to things without any regard for what it means, sure. Like, why not? Like, it's a great comedy that doesn't really have any,
have a particular genre of, Monty Python has that. I mean, Monty Python is one of the most popular comedy troupes in the history of mankind. So it's just ridiculous to say that their most beloved movie is somehow just because geeks also happen to like it. It is extremely popular.
Yes, it has, you know, annual showings
it's turned into a hit musical in Las Vegas, for God's sake.
I think that in maybe my favorite episode of The Simpsons, Homer goes to college and he meets up with these three geeks and like they are quoting like Monty Python routines. And so it might be like an older sort of stereotype.
I think it's probably older. Yeah.
But it rings hollow for me to say that. I watched it in sixth grade. My dad recommended it to me. Like My dad is definitely not a geek in any sense of that. So I think it's a comedy film. You know, make Die Hard a geek movie at this point in time if you're going to do that. Like, what the hell? What does it mean? It's like right. You said in the first thing, like that word is going to be looked back with just utter scorn from people 30 years from now.
Right. But so he goes through, once again, if you think a description of a video game being played is thrilling stuff, someone reciting the lines from a movie being described in prose is shockingly unreadable.
Yeah, and it kept going. Like, to, you know, we'd already seen this happen in war games, but he let it run on for a page and a half of like, yep, no, we get it. Yeah, that's how the movie goes, and nope, okay, and then, yeah.
Yeah, but here was the shocking thing to me. He's getting fed lines when he fails to get them by his confreres.
Yeah.
So he's just flat out cheating. I mean, this is cheating and everyone can see it, right?
And in spite of the fact that he had watched the movie 157 times and knew every word by heart, he very quickly is like goofing around and talking to them. So he tells Shoto to shut up, and that gets points off.
Right.
He flubs six or seven lines. So yeah, he doesn't know it as well as he has claimed. And then Artemis is like, he starts cracking up because she's doing pitch perfect recitations of all of Carol Cleveland's lines, which is, again, it's like him trying to get the high score in that last game. It's like, shut the hell up and move on with this thing. Like, what on earth is wrong with you people?
The 18 Sixers, who are nipping at his heels to defeat his only dream in life, obviously have the exact wording of every line for this movie.
Yeah.
Which they can feed in probably automatically through. So it's
Sorrento probably is like shocking their scrotums every time that they like, you know, blink their eyes or like take a sip of water to keep them on track for this $1 billion prize.
Right. So needless to say, he defeats the what is it? Flick Sync.
Yeah. Which it just involves getting to the end. None of the points mattered.
Yeah.
Like it didn't. You just had to get through to the final room, which is the replica of Anorak's inner sanctum, which is full of classic home computer and video game systems.
Which he, an entire paragraph of listing old computer systems. I have to admit, I did not read that paragraph. I scanned it with my eyes, saw the numbers and names, and just went immediately past it.
Right. Yeah, most of them hadn't worn mentions to this point, but I did. I appreciated it. He just, in the middle of that list, it just said, various Nintendo and Sega game systems, which I interpreted it just as being like, the lawyers being like, and not one word more. There we go. Like, these very popular systems that sort of actually made this whole video game boom possible. Like, we can't do anymore.
But this brings up to me one of my favorite details from the whole book. He knew the room. He recognized it. Uh-huh. He knew its every detail. Do you remember how he knew that?
No, I mean, was it in the almanac?
It was in the almanac, but how did it get in the almanac? This was his secret lair.
Okay.
Halliday's room had been described in great detail by the movers. After he died, the movers went into his room, and one of the movers, who currently had a an armoire over his shoulder with a moving strap attached to his... and stopped, took note of all the different computer systems and described them in great detail. That's how he knew that.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. So they're just like guys who are like just sweating their asses off and are like, oh God, like we just got to call in. We got to go to another house. I thought we were getting off after this, but it's going to be a lot more work.
We got to do old Lady Johnson's place after this, you know. Yes. He relights his cigar. All right, yeah. Look.
I haven't really recovered from throwing out my back moving that piano last week, but I need the OT. look at that. Is that a TRS-80? that is classic.
I wish he'd designed this place more like Rivendell. That's more to my taste.
I gotta take some notes. This might come in handy if the press has any questions about this. They could sell it to us. I could use that extra $10 that I lost on disability.
Yeah, so that's how he got it. I now realize we should have, of course, pre-produced a sketch of the...
Yeah, that would have been much better. Wow. Well, that's, yeah, I didn't take note of that. That's hilarious. So I hope that gets some scenes in the movie.
Yes. So he walks around. He tries to unlock the, so this is, I mean, this is it. This is the moment. Yeah. We know this is it.
It's all built to this.
Yeah. And it's a bunch of computers. And what he tries to do is just go to his, what he knew was like his favorite system or, I don't know, the first system he ever owned or something like that. And he tries to log in. And so this is the moment. This is the moment when in the hero's journey, in the, you know, this is where our hero takes some bit of information. He overcomes his own limitations. You know, he overcomes his own hubris. he finds within himself some sort of courage or humility or bravery that he had not had before, but he'd been on a journey that had steeled him for this very exciting moment. And yes. And what happens?
He types in a few things. Logs into the computer system.
Yes.
He tries to do a we're in to the, and he guesses, he's trying to guess people's names, which is like, you know, the guy's name. He types in Gunting. He types in house coats. But the things he actually types in are like the guy's pet, like his dog.
No, it's better than that. This is a detail I wrote down. He typed in the name of the ferret he'd once owned. Now, I actually
that it was his most beloved son was the one in War Games or something.
Right, right. I wrote down that if that had actually unlocked, it all might have been forgiven with her.
Yeah, that was the key to everything.
The ferret he'd once owned.
He was like, yeah, I had it. You know, it was one of those things that seemed like a good idea, but I had to give it to a ferret rescue. It was like,
oh, ferrets are the worst. Yeah. Oh, God. I didn't spend any time with it. They're not very lovable.
Weird ferret guys drove down from New Jersey to pick it up. It was like, I guess it's worth a 3-hour drive for them. But
yeah, that was, they started to take extensive notes on my computer system. I had to kick them out of my inner sanctum.
Yeah. So the reason that he has to try all these guesses is because he tries to talk to his buddies, but he says Halliday had coded this final stage of the gate so that no outside communication was possible. And then this is, I mean, if you have the edition we have, you just draw a line from that sentence directly across the page where he says, Sorrento was probably with a team of Halliday scholars whispering suggestions in his ear thanks to his hacked immersion rig, which, you know, is a... I don't know if he means that his rig can overcome that, but it doesn't even give you a page to digest the details before forgetting them and moving on to a completely contradictory reality.
Which, yeah, and then he later contradicts it again, too, when he, obviously, he completes the mission by typing in the name of, it's just a different, like the D&D name of the woman he loved or something, whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Who cares?
So he gets it, he gets the egg, and he stares at it in stunned silence for a while, which was good because I imagine he had just been doing a lot of, you know, typing and being, you know, doing come on, come on, come on as he was typing that. He had been vocalizing a lot to himself in the empty room virtual reality before that. So now he's stunned. It's stunned to silence.
He'd been up till that point. He was whistling the Jeopardy theme and, you know, I did note that there's a lot of stunned silence in the section that we read at the end.
Really?
Yeah. Stunned silence was everywhere. Silent screams and stunned silence and things like that.
Wow. So yeah, he gets the egg and he takes it up to the top of the tower, where he, places it in a chalice or something. And then Halliday appears to him.
Just a guy in a t-shirt. I think he notes that he's pale.
Yeah. He's less attractive. Which Halliday's got to be like, well, come on, this is not, you don't need to tell the rest of the people about that part of it. Like, but he sort of, he pulls back a curtain and reveals the kill switch that he can, you know, Wade has won this whole thing. He's inherited not only the billions, but the rights to the whole Oasis. And Halliday sort of says, like, if you ever want, you can come in here, hit the button, and it'll initiate a worm that deletes everything. He doesn't really explain why he would want to do that. But
no,
then he, and it doesn't really seem like Wade's considering it either. But it's sort of there. But then Halliday, this was fun for me. So Lauren had read this far in the book. She had finished it before me. And she, unbeknownst to me, had gone through and marked a sentence before I got to there. So she had written OMFG next to Halliday's big reveal, which is when he tells Wade, hey, man, reality is real.
Yeah.
And so that was her she couldn't believe that the book had built to this entire thing. And it really was just, that was, we talked about it last time, how the editor on the back of the cover was sort of like, he has to overcome his fear of the real world type of thing. And we emphasize that this has not really been something.
This has not been a theme. It's not been a theme with Halliday's. That hasn't been a trail that he sniffed out with Halliday. It hasn't paralleled his life to Halliday's. No, not a bit. Nothing.
It's like how in it was a running joke, but in shows like Community or South Park, they would parody how a sitcom would come and sort of preach you a moral at the end, where a character's like, "Hey guys, what we really learned today is that friendship is truer than any." You know, that type of garbage. And so that's what he did at the end of the book. He had this guy come in and launch into this garbage about how you've got to live your life. You know, real connections are the thing you've got to get.
And then his little chuck on the chin at the end is, and hey, use it for good, will you? It's like, well, what's good to you, you freak, shut in weirdo?
Yes, exactly.
What good have you done? You haven't done any good. So what good am I supposed to do?
Right. From all we could tell, this has contributed a lot towards the fall of mankind.
Right.
So it reminded me, too, of this. I had to reach out to some friends, but there had been a running joke in college. Just the triteness of his statement, reality is real. Which, again, the number one quote on Goodreads was the guy saying going outside is highly overrated, which people took away. That's what people took away from it. They're like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like life is partly worth living. The only thing making it bearable is video games. Those are sort of like, people took that away like they took away greed is good from Wall Street.
Right. Like
they didn't take away that this is a despicable character and we're supposed to think he's an idiot for believing these things. But I digress. The triteness of it, though, reminded me of a guy. My friend was at a bar in college, and there was a guy that he didn't like sort of writing conspicuously in a moleskin next to him.
Sure.
And so he was like, all right, like I got to. What are you writing down? And the guy sort of turned his book around and showed it to him. And the one thing that my friend saw at the top of the page, he had written down, rocket science is not rocket science.
Wow.
He was like, what do you mean? And the guy's like, it's not, man. Just think about it. Like people do that. People, you know, rockets, they figure that out. Like we could study that. We could learn it. It's within our grasp type of thing. And he was like, I'm not even finishing my beer. I'm getting up and walking away. So It struck me. So that was something we talked about all through college, making fun of that guy. And that was essentially what the grand moral of this story ended up being.
Hey, look, it's either have that written in the moleskin book or it's carrying around the art of war. All right. I got to do one or the other.
So if you're the guy who wrote that in a book in Charlottesville in 2002 or 2003, people still talk about that.
Before we move on to meeting of Artemis, we've been going around it, but let's get right to it. This guy, Halliday, he's a monster, and his game is monstrous. It is a horrible act of ego. The game, again, involves there's no lessons learned. There's nothing. It continues all the way through is nothing but rote memorization. There was no courage. Nothing was required other than all of those things, right? I just do not understand why this got compared, to Willy Wonka or any of those others, where there's at least, it's kind of weirdly warped as some of those lessons are. They're clear in the actual, game, the rules of the game.
Yeah, but, it's on the front of the book or the back of the book, calling it Willy Wonka. I think that was from the AV Club review. All Charlie did was he constantly proved himself trustworthy. You know, he proved the entire Boy Scout code in the face of a bunch of idiot, selfish children who did not like all. You know, that was what he had going for him, his code of morality.
Yeah, this requires none of that. It requires you will have studied me. In all my weirdness, and then at the end, there's nothing about those two, again, that sort of, he fixes nothing in him, he fixes nothing vice versa. This Halliday guy, to quote and Norm MacDonald, this guy's a real jerk. I mean, there's nothing noteworthy or nice about him or courageous or, he's not like a frail guy who seems weird like Willy Wonka and then turns out to have been playing some sort of other game on a different level. Not at all, not a bit.
And he's he's coded the final room so that no one else can watch this interaction where he gives that community type of speech telling him to go outside and reality is real. So that's Wade can just choose to keep that to himself.
Right.
And the only reason that Wade even has any desire to not take his spaceship into the world, into the thing, and load it up with snacks and couches and a hard drive with every video game ever made is because he met someone doing this. So I guess Halliday was just making a big assumption that you were going to encounter the Rubenesque woman that you've been jacking it to all these years, and that she was going to somehow, through the magic of love, transform you into a non-selfish person who would want to be someone worthy. Because once you've solved this, all the stuff that he's made you memorize is devoid of merit. Like, he didn't necessarily like any of this stuff because he enjoyed it. He just watched it over and over again because this guy told him to. So now that there's no more egg hunt, like, where do you go from here with all this knowledge you've memorized? Like, maybe you just hope that a bar trivia night's going to have an 80s night category that you can go and be like, oh, sweet. Like, I've really been studying my whole life for this. I can win a free pitcher.
Nope. The only place it goes is into a WAN embarrassing, face reddening, weak romance. And that is pretty much where the book ends up. I don't know where to begin quoting this. This is just, this is golden stuff.
So he goes outside, he wipes out all the other guys with his super user powers, and then this was a really dramatic moment for me. He says that he can do whatever he wants, but he wishes for Artemis H and Shoto to be resurrected. So it's a big dramatic moment. It's sort of like Dorothy, No Place Like Home. But before all that happens, to undermine that, a dialogue window popped up asking me to confirm the spelling of each of their avatar names. Once I did, the system asked me if, in addition to resurrecting their avatars, I wanted to restore all of their lost items too. I tapped the yes icon. So that's going to be a really awesome moment in the movie when he makes this big wish, and then he has to sort of like, you know, are you sure moments, and then Clippy pops up asking if he wants to do that. And that's just another funny thing about the cinema qualities of virtual reality.
He had to scroll through the end user license agreement. You had to, oh, I didn't scroll through. I have to actually scroll all the way down before I can click yes. It's still grayed out.
Jasmine pop up, like, enters the thing. He's like, well, get rid of that. Like, this is not.
The CAPTCHA comes up. But this is also non-dramatic because he was already going to share the winnings with them. He had announced that to the world in his pledge.
Right.
So, I mean, they're not, can't they just buy their way in? This is, you know, they're powerhouses within the Halliday universe. It's not like his restoring them. It's like, no, I'll just restore myself later. You know what? Don't even waste the time. I'll do it. They are not locked out. They're like billionaires who are, you know, the winners of the proceeds already. So they can do whatever they want.
Right. You wonder how that sort of influx of cash would have on, like, the economy of all of this nonsense. Like, it could really, it could just sort of, it'd be like when a country adds 3 zeros to their currency and everyone suddenly has a lot less money than they did. So that's they leave that. Artemis doesn't show, and he degunts back into Og's place. And Og tells her that she's waiting for him at the center of his hedge maze.
Yes, Og is a richly drawn character too. He's just always like bear hugging people and like, thanks for everything, Og. No, thank you. He's just like, have some snacks.
I had no, there was nothing sinister about me. There was nothing that I wanted. I just sort of, I've got it good, and I want everyone else to have it good too.
Yeah, so head out to the Rivendell maze and find your true love.
When he leaves, he sort of says to those guys, he's like, wait, you actually saw Artemis? And he goes, how did she look? Which is his obsessions are just so clearly shallow on the surface. It just is, even at this point in the book, it was really just really stood out.
Well, if she does turn out again to be Harry Knuckled Chuck, which we already know that she's not, right? He knows her. But even so, he still would love her every bit as much. He has made that clear. So. Yeah. The meeting, when they meet, includes one of my favorite sentences in the book as well.
All right.
He walks up to her and, "You look just like I always pictured you," I said. "Beautiful." "Really?" she said softly. Slowly, she turned to face me. So she was facing away. And when he already said she looked like you pictured her. "Taking in my appearance a little at a time, starting with my feet and then gradually working her way up to my face." It's just such a weird detail.
Yeah.
So he noted that she turned around, her eyes were down, and she slowly, like, "Okay, I got the shoes. Oh, he ties them under and then over. That's interesting. Oh, I think those are blue jeans." Like, you don't look at a person that way. It's impossible.
Yeah, unless you're doing like the full David Lee Roth, like, shades flip and like up and down scope, like then nodding to the camera.
Yeah.
Chicka chicka.
Yeah. Oh, that is so bizarre.
But yeah, she says, she's sort of like tearing up and says, "I'm sorry for breaking things off with you." And Wade says, "It's okay. I understand why you did it now." And I sort of was like, "Well, please fill me in. I haven't picked up on any real motivation."
Yeah,
yet.
I noted that too. I didn't get that. What? Why?
Things happened because they were convenient to the plot or just had to have a character act like a, you know, whiny kid for a while. So that was all I really picked up on.
Yeah. What is the new information where he understands it?
I don't know. It didn't help him Gunt any better. Like, he was standing outside her planet with a boombox for 3 hours. Right. So
he was diving into memorizing manga and stuff like that.
Yes. But yeah, so it keeps going, and finally they stand up and he says, "I love you," and then she says, like, "You're my best friend," which I thought was going in a funny direction, which that would have been pretty cool too. But then she kisses him, and he says that it felt like all those songs and poems promised it would.
Yeah, that was in fanfic from earlier. That was one of our fanfic lines, yeah.
And I think that tricked me up because I didn't believe that he would have read a poem.
Right.
It certainly wasn't anything. I don't know. I don't know who an 80s poet would even be. That reflects poorly on me, but it, whoever it is, he hasn't read it. But then he says it also felt like being struck by lightning.
Yep.
That's what love is like. Positive feeling we all have,
right?
And thing that we wish would happen to us.
I knew a guy who was. It is not pleasant. The exit wounds left some grisly scars on this man.
Oh God! Yeah. Yes.
So that's what he said. It was not a pleasant experience. I do note that after that line about how she looked at him, starting with his feet, then I kept being thrown off by, like, she gave me a shy smile. So he should have added, "I was looking at her face at that moment." You know, like, which part, how can you see that? Are you looking at her feet or are you scanning from the other? I was like, all right, if you can see her smiling, all right, I'll just assume from now on that you're looking at the part that you're describing.
Yeah, if you want to take a look at the feet, please note that you've scanned the whole body down to that point.
Right, and if you are not also looking at her feet, please indicate that you're sort of holding your hand kind of horizontally under your eyes to block that part of the person.
he ends by saying that he has absolutely no desire to log back into the Oasis. And that's
this is
that's
also how, fresh information for us.
Yes, exactly. He was already delighted by having a long list of new magic spells and items and super user abilities, but now that he's kissed someone, I guess you sort of leave that all behind and move on.
Yep. Now you go to, instead of in this amazing virtual world, now you go to actual pizza parlors, classic 80s pizza parlors, and stand at a game all day with the girl next to you watching going, "What time can we leave?" So he's got a bright future ahead.
Yeah, you put your name on the Arby's waiting list and just sort of set the clock for 2 years from now and move it along. But that's how it ends. But it was impossible for me not to look at the next page, where right off the bat you have one of the first five people he thanks is disgraced Austin film critic Harry Knowles, which is a more fitting way for the book to end.
Yes.
Just this guy is going to be forever associated in your compliments. And I looked, there's been no Ernest Cline sort of Quentin Tarantino or Ben Affleck sort of backpedaling, being like, "I should have done more." So
I did not know him to be this kind of a person.
Right.
Yeah. I assumed he sort of hovered over the whole mess when I was reading it. I guess I.
Yeah.
So that's good confirmation.
I went back and looked to sort of see, because, you know, something like this, it needs a sort of in, like a champion or something like that. And Harry Knowles was talking about it pretty early on, before it was even out, or before the movie was coming along. He was sort of giving him his props in his traditional revolting style on the site. So
yeah, talk about someone who can put some gruesome prose out there. Harry Knowles can really bring it too. He can bring the hurt.
Do not Google Harry Knowles Blade 2. yeah.
So there we go. What a journey. What a journey it's been. Do you think you've grown or learned anything?
So, you know, the whole thing that my takeaway from this would be to a reader of this or a listener of this is just go out there and make something of your own. Like, this is just you saw the value of what people have done, what other creative people have done in terms of this guy, just sort of like listing them and reciting them. And, you know, whether you can do something that's popular or not popular, there's value in creating something that is more than just reciting things that came before it or telling people what you like. So I think that if there's any good you can bring into this world after having read this book, it would be to, you know, do something of your own.
Right. Yeah. Well, you took something positive away from it. Mine's going to be my only thing was that as it went on, I honestly, the reading of it, I resented having to do it. And last night, I don't mean that to, you know, sound so negative to people who enjoyed the book. Like what you like. I don't really, you know, there's no moral judgment in liking something that I think is inferior or vice versa. I mean, I like a lot of stuff that is would be ridiculous to other people. I've extolled the virtues of Roadhouse, for crying out loud. I know how to get down there in the mud with stuff that is critically not, you know, not great. I know how to enjoy it. So there's no judgment coming from this end. I just didn't enjoy it. And towards the end, like last night, I was still polishing off the rest of the book, and I'm in bed dictating into my phone lines from it, you know, while my wife is trying to sleep next to me. It's like, what have I done? Yes. What have I become? I echo your sentiments, but also that's what I want to be the takeaway, is like, if you like it, you like it. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I will not judge you. You can still be my friend if you sure. like it. So where from here? What, this well, is the end.
Yeah, and we've got a couple of sentences we can share. People wrote in.
Oh, yeah, we have done sentence emails of the week. Yeah. I got so teary-eyed over the whole thing that I forgot our whole procedure.
Yes.
I just wanted to leave us weeping. But no, we have much more joy to go. We have the dumb sentence of the week.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period or an exclamation.
Yes, indeed. It's that time. Dumb sentence of the week.
Oh, yeah.
This has been a lot of fun to root these great. Out, and this section did not skimp, did it?
No, it did not. There was so much good stuff here, and people wrote in with theirs. I'm going to come right and say it. I burnt mine. That was the you'll be wiping with one hand. It was nothing was going to top that for me, but some other people found some pretty good ones. First of all, Daniel K. wrote in. He said, this one needs some explanation, but the feds just took Sorrento in for questioning. They stormed into IOI headquarters and yanked him right out of his haptic chair. And so, yeah, Daniel says, while it may seem inoffensive at first, what struck me about this sentence was how it was recapitulated a favorite Kleinian motif. Witness, page 273. When the drop cop finished strapping on the ball gag, he grabbed me by the exoskeleton of my haptic suit, yanked me out of my haptic chair like a rag doll, and threw me on the floor.
Ah, beautiful.
Page 293. Dato's apartment. I watched in horror as they rushed in, yanked him out of his haptic chair, and threw him off the balcony.
I just noted. There's a lot of yanking out of haptic chairs.
That's the best way to leave a haptic chair. You good old-fashioned yanking.
I did notice, though, that it is very fitting that the arch evil enemy of the book is a frog walked out in his hell of a rig, man. I thought that was very fitting.
Yes, it was just, you know, hopefully there weren't any nothing dangling out of the openings as his
the lawyers' openings.
God, that was hilarious. I mean, and those have to be sort of a humiliating, you know, sort of like a Green Man looking suit, I would guess. So it's not going to, or a Andy Serkis mocap type of thing. So it's exactly. Not a good look for going out in public.
Yeah, it does not flatter any part of the male anatomy.
The next book, I forgot to take the name of someone who wrote this in, but it says... Their dumb sentence actually came from the acknowledgments right under Harry Knowles. It says, Julian's startling intelligence, insight, and relentless attention to detail helped me shape Ready Player One into the book I'd always wanted it to be, and he made me a better writer in the process. And so they wrote, based on that, I can only conclude that the first draft of this book was a computer game manual and a single Dorito inside a Tron DVD cover with a post-it note with the word this scrawled on it in crayon. Either that or Julian is a potato. That isn't a metaphor. And then they said, of all the terrible and deluded artistic endeavors I've experienced over the years, thanks to Riff Tracks, this book is the absolute worst.
Wow. Which,
you know, that's so think about that. That's Roller Gator, fun in balloon land. Like,
that is high or low praise, I guess.
Yeah,
depending.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Wow, that's nice.
Yeah. Well, do you have any more?
I do. I'm surprised they didn't come up. Yours was burnt, right?
Yes. So I, you know, needed to talk about it in the moment.
Okay. Well, this here's a lesser one because I marked a few because I figured listeners would be burning a few and maybe we'd just sort of hit on them. So while there was a little talk of comlinks and things, which I know.
Okay, yes.
So the comlinks thing was explained. There was an earlier dumb sentence, but this is H shouting into his comlink. It is on, H shouted. It is on like red dawn.
God.
Ugh. God. So that's bad. But this one I think would be my dumb sentence of the week. He's making his worldwide appeal. You know, everybody, the entire world is watching him play Tempest, right? And then he's getting the clues from his other compatriots for the rest of the stuff. They're able to listen in, I guess, on private comlinks. I don't know if their avatars were
transparent.
I don't know. I don't know. He did not say. I wish he were there to describe it, but he was not. But so he's making this appeal, and it's like a heartfelt, like, look, I'm making this to the world, my solemn oath, blah, blah, blah. I'm splitting all the winnings, and then concludes with, if I'm lying, I should be forever branded as a gutless sixer filleting punk.
Gah.
I love that that was your reaction was pretty much identical in both of them.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. So that's his appeal to the world, this 17-year-old kid that's becoming this is at his heroic moment. This is the hero's the hero's moment. You know, this is Aragorn becoming who Aragorn will be with his with his speech. This is Henry V. We happy few, we band of brothers. This is his, a Gunter or a Sixer filleting punk. That's his.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a scheme of Halliday's to like have the guy be so deeply unappealing that his message to like go outside and enjoy reality is something they just intuit from watching this idiot succeed. Like, oh, God, right. I don't want to sit here and watch this guy. If this guy is what I look like doing this, man, like, I'm going to go on a hike.
Right. All right. Well, that's it. I mean, there's nothing more to say.
Yeah, a few listener emails I would like to read.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, hey, I keep forgetting our departments. See, I'm getting too nostalgic for something that hasn't even ended. So here we go. let's do some stealing people's mail.
Yeah.
We go to the party. We go to the game. We go to the disco. And gonna cruise out, man. Stealing people's mail. Stealing people's mail. Stealing people's mail.
Steal the people's mail. All right.
So, yes. Yeah, this is an email. And, geez, let me look up who it was because it was a good one.
Do you need cover for this? Should I
do a
quick 5 minutes of my stand-up comedy from the classic 80s comedy?
Yes, please. Pull down your own brick wall. And
I have just pushed up the sleeves of my formless jacket, and nice. I have an ironic T-shirt underneath it. So
lovely. So this was from Meredith. She wrote in, one thing that has struck me the most with the first-person narration is our main character's way of prefacing every description with a comparison, reference, and or general impression. As you pointed out, he over-explains without actually providing clear descriptions of things. And then she says, In a 1980 interview with Spanish writer-director Vicente Molina Fuax, Stanley Kubrick stated, "I read an essay by the great master H.P. Lovecraft where he said that you should never attempt to explain what happens as long as what happens stimulates people's imagination, their sense of the uncanny, their sense of anxiety and fear." And then Stanley Kubrick was commenting on Stephen King's The Shining. He highlighted a sentence. It was as if there was another overlook now lay scant inches beyond this one, separated from the real world, if there was a such thing as a real world, Jack thought, but gradually coming into balance with it. And Stanley Kubrick noted in the right-hand margin, "Don't explain." And so so Meredith has then did some control effing of her own. She says the phrase "as if" shows up 36 times in Ready Player One, "looked like" shows up 26 times, "appeared to" 33 times, and the phrase "seemed to" comes up a whopping 72 times. The count for Kubrick, one.
Wow. That's good. Yeah, that's
fun. Deep dive into the more critical aspects of what went wrong here.
Yeah, and don't they say in politics too? If you're explaining, you're losing. You know.
Yes.
Yeah. Just everything has to be right out there. But yeah, he did it in a way that I mean, as you said, when he tries to get into descriptive writing, it is always a wreck, and that's why I found the. You know, the mech fights so unreadable to me. Like, I just can't, I don't know. Just the names of things that I'm supposed to pull up and then watching them crash together. It really would be like, I think Michael Richards, when he was on Fridays, do you remember that show that was like Saturday night? Like, he used to do a segment where he was like a weird little kid who would just crash robots together and in a dirt, on a dirt mound. I thought it was an odd segment, but that was one of his characters. But that's what it reminds me of just him. Like, he's a little kid and he's just crashing the robots together. Nice. How to describe that? I don't know. Here's what they are, you know, so. Spot on.
Yeah, so there's a few more emails. Before we get to it, I'd asked you about this beforehand, but I don't want this book in my house anymore.
Yes. And
I assume you feel the same way. But so I took a bunch of notes in here. They're probably barely legible, but I thought that we're coming out to Minneapolis in a couple of days. We could sign the books and put them up on eBay if you want to look at the notes I took. And we'll donate all that, anything, the small amount of money I imagine someone might be willing to pay for these two used copies of the books, donate that to like a charity that encourages creative arts.
I will do the same.
We'll put up a link to that on Facebook and Twitter maybe tomorrow. But, you know, I don't assume that anyone values this too much. But if you're interested, we'll donate the money to a good cause.
Now, wait a minute. Before you finish that, I would like to point out I was talking to a friend yesterday and he refused to pay for the book because he knew that it, you know, was he knew what it was. And so he went to the library and he tried. And I guess there is a library Kindle rental, right?
Yeah.
But you're in a waiting list. And so that was absurd. He said the waiting list for the Kindle thing was absurd. And the waiting list for the physical book.
No.
He waited for weeks, and so when he returned it, he checked again, and the list had only grown huger.
Oh.
So I'm saying is don't discount even on its face. I mean, we don't add anything of particular value, but people might just want the damn book.
Sure, I guess so. Wow. My one thing that I had my fingers crossed for was like, it doesn't look like a lot of people are currently engaged about this book, like on Ready Player One subreddit. Like there's just, it doesn't really get a lot of traffic. So I was like, maybe it's just going to like come and go in March, like some other bad, you know, Guy Ritchie's King Arthur movie last year. And then that's the last we'll have to hear about it. But if people are still trying to get it at the library, oh, well. There's that. Look for that link. The last couple emails, though, this is from Brian. "I really think that you should continue with Ernest Cline. He has a 370-page book called Armada that is about as good as a pile of steamed rats." David said, so Armada is next. Yeah, Armada is next, right?
Right.
Lisa says, "May I recommend Cline's Armada? While I got through Ready Player One without too much trouble, I could only get through Chapter One of Armada. I'd be willing to try to slog through it again if you guys would podcast it." Douglas says, "I'm subjecting myself to Armada, which is somehow lazier and more reference-heavy. I hope you guys do a podcast about it." And then Kevin wrote in on Twitter, "Guess what I found in a bargain bin? Who's ready for 349 pages we'll never get back?" And I, you know, that it was at the end of our chapter at the book. It was, I read three pages of it before I put it down, but it has a world-weary narrator who's above it all.
Yeah.
Page two contains a Star Wars reference. Page three, he references his favorite video game. And then the next paragraph has a Star Wars reference and then says, this was full of the implausible shit that only happened in cheesy 80s movies like Tron or War Games or The Last Starfighter.
I just opened the book myself. I will add this. This is on the spot, impromptu here. After too much wine and too many back-to-back viewings of Say Anything.
Okay.
So there you go.
So it seems very similar, but somehow worse. I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
Oh.
We can take a break. We can take some time off. We can read something good, or we can go to the opera or something.
Yeah, well, you're here in town. Connor lives, he lives in an undisclosed location. I think everybody knows I live in Minneapolis. He's coming into town for a few days. So, yeah, if we could just, I don't know, go see a Mozart symphony or something beforehand, then I will. If you do that, I will agree.
All right, sweet. Well, we can look for that, maybe with enough time to decompress.
All right, that's it.
Well, oh, no, we have one more thing. This is the best email. We got two awesome emails this week.
Oh, okay. Sorry, we weren't done with reading people's mail.
Nathan, a listener, wrote in. He recorded his own audio skit of the alternate ending to the book, which was very, very funny. We posted that on Twitter and Facebook, so look for that. But then we had one more guy write in, Taylor Connor, who I think in our first or second episode, someone had emailed saying that this was like We Didn't Start the Fire Without the Music.
Oh, right, yeah.
Taylor recorded his own We Didn't Start the Fire version that is a Ready Player One, but also a 372 pages We'll Never Get Back inspired. It was also very, very funny. It had spot on references, really well done. So I thought that that would be a great way to play us out, so to speak.
what was his name again?
Taylor Connor.
Taylor, I am I'm looking at you right now. I'm starting at the feet. And then I'm working my way up. And okay, now I'm looking at your face and thanking you for this, because I did hear it. It's very, very funny. And yeah, let's play us out. Play us out of the whole series with our thanks to everyone.
Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, amazing.
It's really fun to do this.
They followed along the whole way, Connor.
I believe some of them didn't even read the book. So,
all right.
Thanks again.
All right. We will maybe see you again. And maybe. Yeah. All right. So long.
Bye.
When it came to my research, I never took any shortcuts. Over the past 5 years, I'd worked my way down the entire recommended Gunter reading list. Douglas Adams, Kurt Vonnegut, Neal Stephenson, Richard K. Morgan, Stephen King, Orson Scott Card, Terry Pratchett, Terry Brooks, Bester, Bradbury, Haldeman, Heinlein, Tolkien, Vance, Gibson, Gaiman, Sterling, Moorcock, Scalzi, Solanzi. I read every novel by every single one of Halliday's favorite authors, and I didn't stop there.
Oasis Halliday, big announcement giveaway. Planet Earth is in decay, but no one seems to know. Easter egg, anorak, classic arcade almanac, hidden gates, hidden keys, Gunter's on the go. Wade Watts, poverty, goods and workers, Mrs. G, living in a lightning rod. By the way, there's no God. Chat room, Cheshire grin, talking about Star Wars again. I rock, smack talk, did these people just applaud?
1980s reference, everyone has viewed it, so I must include it. 1980s reference, it received attention, so it's worth a mention.
Two more floors, D&D, Game of Joust, Copper Key, Artemis is blowing kisses, but she could be Chuck. Middletown, Destination, War Games, Movie Simulation, fans of mindless recitation, boy, are you in luck. Chat, Blink, Cash, Bribe, IOI, Evil Vibe, Suck, Source, Corporate Phony, Sore, Rental, Likes, Cajonies, Bomb Explodes, Lump in Throat, Unexpected, Tragic Note, Trailers Frying, People Dying, Think of All the House Goats.
1980s reference, simple recognition is my only mission. 1980s reference, if it gets a smirk here, then I've done my work here.
Samurai high five, gotta run to stay alive. Cover tracks, get new bio, blow the stacks for Ohio. Great odd birthday bash, grooves
zone, party crash, broken hearts, mermaid fins. Oh yeah, R2-D2 spins. Boot suit, stink tower, Uber Betty, cold shower, open news to use the can, one hell of a rig man. Zork house, cellar door, labyrinth to explore, any tension is destroyed by monsters you can just avoid.
1980s reference, hope you're not begrudging my incessant nudging. 1980s reference, you're no longer grinning, is your patience thinning?
Blade Runner, armed guards, writing action scenes is hard. John Woo, Chow Yun Fat, why not just imagine that? Alex Lifeson, Geddy Lee, Neil Peart, Crystal Key, guitar hidden in the grave. Yes, that's how his name should sound. Drop cops, cyber bums, dude with software in his plums. When this guy wants to log off, he has to turn his head and cough.
1980s reference, so sometimes I pander, do you have to slander? 1980s reference, come on, don't diminish it until you finish it.
Hard time, wage slave, prison break, close shave, sweet freedom, fresh air, almost spent a week in there. Rent a haptic grip till dawn, just don't turn a black light on. Akamaro, Rivendell, H has come out of her shell. Big battle, final test, laser shooting, metal breast, Johnny Fives, robo knives, cataclysm, extra lives. Wade wins, he's the king, money will fix everything. First kiss, fade to black, can I get my pages back?
1980s reference, look, this isn't Shakespeare, so just pump your brakes here. 1980s reference, it's just a paperback, so could you cut some slack, some slack, some slack, some slack, some slack, some slack. 1980s reference, it was hire an editor or pay my creditors. 1980s reference, you should have read the versions with the ALF discursions. 1980s reference, didn't make you buy it, I don't wanna riot. 1980s reference, there's no need for violence, could we have some silence? 1980s reference, want some merch perhaps, I have these baseball caps. 1980s reference, take a shirt or 20, Spielberg gave me plenty. 1980s.